Just a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Stephen Leib, author of several best-selling books, and we're looking forward to his next tome, his magnum opus, On the Yellow Metal. Welcome back, Dr. Stephen Leib.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's a pleasure being back.
It's always our pleasure. We have an explosive stock market, and we have the looks like the bottoming of the precious metals. Let me let you run with the ball.
Yeah, I think, Chris, I mean, everything that you say is right, from cryptocurrency, strong stock market. My guess and my thinking is a lot of this is basically centered around China. I continue to believe that China is ever more becoming the center of the world. And we're not really, you know, rightly or wrongly. I'm not making any, you know, political judgments. I'm just saying that our policies right now is sort of inward looking. We no longer are, you know, interested in making broad-based treaties, especially with the Pacific country, I mean, the Asian countries and the eastern part of the world. And China has jumped in. Now there are things called the SCO, which is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I'll tell you, Chris, I mean, when I look at the history of just this one organization, I know a lot of people talk about One Belt, One Road, and that's a very, very meaningful and large, potentially massive trading network, security network, et cetera, that's likely to encompass Eurasia, part of Africa. But the SCO is sort of emblematic of what China does. This organization began with about six countries in 1996, which was before China was ever in the WTO. Countries from Central Asia, don't ask me to pronounce their names, and China and Russia. Then they added another country in Central Asia in 2001 to the organization. And recently, within the last few weeks, or certainly the last month at most, they added two more countries. Those additional two countries are Pakistan and India. Yes, two countries that don't exactly have a friendly history with each other. They're now part of this really very encompassing organization, which is, you know, offers trade, security services for all. I mean, Chris, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Now becomes, with the addition of Pakistan and India, and again, I have to emphasize, these are not countries that are exactly friendly with each other, but are part of a very encompassing organization, not just in terms of trade, but in terms of security, in terms of, you know, progressing together, etc. I believe it's eight countries now comprise about half the world's population. Well, China still does. I mean, the SCO still does allow observer status to other countries, etc., especially in Asia. They denied the U.S. The U.S. could not even observe what's going on in the SCO. And I believe this is sort of emblematic. It's not sort of. It is emblematic of what China is trying to do. They are trying to control the East and the developing world. They're also looking to initiate or bring together this other trade pact, which goes under the so many acronyms. This one goes under the acronym RCEP. And will include a big chunk of the developing world in addition to Japan and South Korea. So this is their a replacement for TPP. If you add up, Chris, all these different organizations, some a bit secretive, but I mean, again, you can find out information. This is not secretive like the trilateral or anything else. It's out there, the SCO, you know who belongs to it, you know what their goals are. And you know, every meeting there's a communique, etc. Between the SCO, between the One Belt, One Road, between the very strong possibility that they will initiate this RCEP, China is at the hub of the developing world. This is amazing. Now, the developing world is now, and I think this is probably the first time in modern economic history, that the developing world, the economies of the developing world, and a lot of this is due to China, but these economies in total are larger than the economies of the developed world. So you have basically a group of countries, which on average, I mean, China has a huge economy, but on average, this group of countries have very small economies or relatively small economies, like India. I mean, as an example, the Philippines, Thailand, I mean, you know, a collection of economies that do not have high standards of living. Tremendous potential for growth. About 75% of oil assets, hydrocarbons, energy assets are located in these countries. And basically, this gives China control of the fastest growing part of the world that now has become the most important part of the world. And I think this is what you're, you know, you are basically seeing now. I mean, the good side of it is that we do have worldwide growth. And it's not bad. It's well over 3%. That's pretty good. The bad side of it is that that growth is centered in the eastern part of the world. So you're getting this split. And my own take is that, and I know this sounds paradoxical, today I'm looking, you know, at my screen and I'm seeing oil down another $2 or $1.80. And I see West Texas trading at about $45. There was a time where these kinds of low oil prices would have been cheered in this country. But now is not the time. And the reason is suddenly higher oil prices in the U.S., not for the rest of the world necessarily, but in the U.S., are bullish for the economy. We had a whole bunch of data today, which was pretty crummy. Inflation was lower. I think retail sales, I mean, everything that, you know, came out was lower. If you look at the data, you will see that so much of our job creation over the last 4 or 5 years, a huge portion of that job creation has come from, guess what? The fracking industry. I mean, fracking is a very expensive in terms of how much resources it takes up, and in terms of how many people it employs. I mean, it's remarkable. I mean, you know, some estimates are several million people. Compare that with 100,000 people or so that work for Saudi Aramco. Fracking is not just, you know, putting a fork in the ground or putting a, you know, a pole in the ground and just watching the oil stir up. It takes unimaginable amounts of sand, water, etc. Drilling, I mean, it's a very, very intensive profession. It takes a lot of people. It takes a lot of energy. But the bottom line is it allows us to circulate money throughout this economy. And that's what's been keeping us going. Now, sooner or later, that's going to stop. I mean, sooner or later, the Saudis will cut back enough. You know, in past periods, they've cut back much, much more than they have in this period. They will cut back enough that oil prices will start to rise, and they'll let our economy go. I mean, and, you know, we'll use up a lot of oil, et cetera. But once oil prices rise, you know, fairly dramatically, I think this economy will be on even better footing. But I also think we will get to a point where the Chinese will say, and this is what I'm coming down to in my very long-winded way. I think the key to gold really breaking out will be when you see, and I think it's not a question of whether, it's a question of when, a Eastern benchmark for oil trading in, are denominated in Chinese yuan, Chinese renminbi. And that, in my opinion, will basically change the entire calculus of the world. It will shift the major market in oil to the East, which is where all the demand will be. I mean, you know, we have no growth in energy demand to speak of in this country, and I think the only growth we have comes from fracking because we need so much energy to get that energy. But basically, the developed world doesn't need to grow their energy, their service economies, etc. It's in the developing world, which is now larger than the developed world, where you're going to see this growth in energy demand. And it's going to be pretty spectacular. I mean, some of these countries that are developing, I mean, they may have $1,500 per capita incomes. I mean, you know, that's a long time, long room for growth, a long, long, long runway. They will be basically in charge. And I think that's when you will see a massive point of inflection. Now, if you ask me when that's going to happen, when will China start trading this benchmark? They've been talking about this for the last 3 or 4 years. There were rumors that they gave up on it this year, but then they said, no, 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 it's on our agenda, etc. And my guess is because of what's happening, because of this opening that has been created for them to, you know, really become the hub of not just, you know, the East, but the developing world, it may come sooner rather than later. So, you know, the message is that we finally have, I think, a major, what I would call the buy signal for gold. And that, again, will be when oil starts to trade on the Shanghai Exchange denominated in renminbi. Now, it may not be, that doesn't mean the day that starts happening that gold's going to shoot up $300. No, but it means that it will happen. I think that's one reason why you've had, you know, a bid under gold at this point. To be honest, I'm somewhat surprised that gold hasn't gone down. I mean, I still expect to get another correction in gold. This is, you know, again, I want to leave your listeners with a very clear, in my opinion, I mean, I could be, you know, dead wrong on this, but in my opinion, a clear buy signal will emerge when oil is traded in renminbi in the East, because that will become the primary benchmark, not only for oil, but then again, all other commodities will be traded in the East, will be denominated in renminbi, and renminbi will be to some extent, I can't describe to you exactly how cryptocurrencies may enter into it, but gold will be part of that equation. I mean, it'll be initially backed by renminbi, and then it'll be renminbi plus, you know, maybe the ruble and gold. And, you know, you talked about cryptocurrencies and this, you know, urge to get a hold of something that's tangible. It will be very likely a cryptocurrency that ends up backing oil trades, other commodity trades, along with the, and that cryptocurrency will consist of partially gold, partial renminbi, partial some other currencies. The dollar will have very, very little role. And the currency and the part of that collection of currencies, which will be a type of cryptocurrency, there'll be a blockchain associated with it. And incidentally, just as a sidebar, China right now has the world's fastest supercomputers, and there's a reason for that, because they see ahead. I mean, it's remarkable how far ahead that they look. So this is basically the heart of the transition that I think you have to be looking for. And I think it's just a matter of time. So, I mean, if you do see a correction in gold, if I happen to be right about this, and you do get something of a correction, and I'm not talking about a 20%, nothing like that at all. I'm talking about, you know, maybe it could be, you know, back to 1200, maybe, you know, undercutting that. And you know, I could be dead wrong. But the point is that if you do see something like that, please don't panic. Don't get upset. We are so close to seeing a major, major shift, a major point of inflection. And all the pieces will, you know, basically come together. I just have to leave this discussion with one point. I mean, the advantage the Asian cultures have is they tend to look so far ahead. I mean, back in 1978, China was mining, I don't know, 6 tons of gold. And they set up a division of their army to go out and, you know, dredge some fields and find out where all the gold was in the country. Now you flash forward, what is it, 40 years? And though China doesn't have massive gold reserves, they are the largest gold producer in the world. And they're mining about 20% of their reserves a year. I don't think in the history of commodity record keeping, we've ever found a country that was mining that percentage of their reserves in a year, on a yearly basis. And every year, they spend more and more money. I mean, they're losing money mining gold, and their accumulation of gold, you know, who knows? But it's enormous at this point, you know, so it's just something else backing things up.
A couple of just key little points here. Vladimir Putin, you may have read, he's meeting with the founder of Ethereum cryptocurrency. That's currently now the second currency just below Bitcoin. You might think of it as, I don't know, the Yahoo under Google. Or this is key because he is thinking strategically. We have a $5 trillion Forex market, so much larger than stocks and bonds, which the typical investor is thinking about. Well, this $5 trillion market, we're looking for up to 10% in the digital space, not just Bitcoin. Bitcoin to absorb about 33% of that 10%. So let's say 3.3%. When you run the numbers, you're talking about a $500 billion market space, if you will, for the digital currencies. This is the best estimates we're seeing from analysts today. Then we multiply that by 10 and we have a market cap on Bitcoin. If you take, let's say, about 35%, you're in the neighborhood of $1.75 to $2 trillion potentially for Bitcoin over the next 10 years or so. What we expect is a 30-fold increase from the current $2,000 to $3,000 price on Bitcoin up to as high as $100,000. That's the thinking there. This is a huge opportunity. I'd like to know your thoughts on the Bitcoin revolution.
I think it's very interesting. I was careful when I was describing how this will end up working because I'm not that sure. I do think that blockchains will be at the center. There's very little doubt. And each of these cryptocurrencies has their own blockchain associated with it. China, incidentally, is the dominant player in bitcoins. And it's very difficult to create an additional bitcoin. And that's a very nice thing about it. And it does make it, because it is well known, and maybe China will elect to go with the bitcoin as to back up gold. And I think you make a really, really good point. Whatever currency, whatever cryptocurrency or combination, maybe it'll be Bitcoin plus another cryptocurrency. Maybe they'll have three blockchains associated with this, sort of like an SDR, a crypto SDR, if you will. I mean, crypto coin SDR. And I think it'll be some sort of combination which is used to end gold. And gold will be there. Because gold is really essential. I mean, you can't, it's hard to, I understand the advantages of Bitcoin. I mean, it's very hard to create a Bitcoin, which is why you need these supercomputers to do it. And it's why China, I think, has put so much effort into going, into developing these supercomputers and why they dominate the Bitcoin market. Last I read, they had a, you know, remarkable share of that. So you could be dead right on this. I don't know how China is thinking. Do they want to set up, you know, another cryptocurrency? Do they want to set up several cryptocurrencies? Do they want to let the Bitcoin rise to, you know, very, very high levels? Because it would. I mean, you put your finger on it when you said that, you know, some incredibly large number per Bitcoin could be. And it could be a wonderful play, and I would not discourage it. I mean, it's certainly wholly consistent with what I think, that cryptocurrencies will play a very important role in what becomes the new monetary system. But gold, I think, will play a critical role as well, because gold is there. It's been there for several millennia, and it will join cryptocurrencies, I think the most important paper currency will be, the renminbi. And, you know, that will solidify China's, you know, basic control, commodity trading throughout the world. You know, it's fascinating what's happening. I hope things work out okay for us, but we're going to have to get on our horse real quickly in this country and realize what's happening. How could we, Chris, fall behind in supercomputers?
I've recently fallen under the spell of quantum computing, and I'll wager that you probably have read up on this topic as well.
I know it reasonably well, but maybe not as well as you, but I have read a lot about it, yes.
And as you may know, it works fantastically on tough-to-solve P versus NP-style problems.
But, I mean, it's funny because what the type of problem that they are really great at are called Embarrassingly.
You're exactly right, and it's cracking so many interesting codes, really. I know a lot of my listeners are cringing, saying, Chris, come on, PEEP versus NPEEP. That's just the tip of the iceberg. But I haven't read enough to know all of the applications. But what I find amazing is you may have seen the D-Wave computer. It's this amazing black box, and it takes up a whole room. You know, it reminds me of ENIAC, if you can go back to your ENIAC days.
And master's, I have a master's in math, PhD in psychology. And when I was there, I mean, I'm dating myself. I mean, we used to have to fill out these punch cards, you know, hand them in, and you'd get, you know, your multiple regression or whatever it was, whatever you wanted to do with your data. It would take you overnight.
Exactly. We're working with, you know, SAS, the SAS programs. We weren't far from your punch cards. Let me just tell you, we were just a step beyond that. So things have changed so much. And one thing I'd like to share with you before we move on, because I'm feeling this topic's going to change quickly. There's so much good stuff for an ICO, which, of course, is an initial cryptocurrency offering. You might just liken it to an IPO. What we're working on is called BitSilver.
You're right there with what I'm saying.
Here's our quick pitch. We recognize the opportunity to differentiate among the crypto peers, because they keep coming back, you know, these top folks in the ICO sphere. They keep saying, why would we need a metal backing when we have this digital currency? It might come in handy at some point. Why don't I let you run with that?
No, I think it definitely will come in handy at a certain point. I mean, one thing, it's very, very hard to create, again, particular cryptocurrencies, and it may take more than one. Because, I mean, you were talking about, I can't remember the number or the price that the Bitcoins would have to trade at. Because basically, I think that there's an ultimate number they can create, and after that, can't create anymore.
Yeah, Jim Cramer recently threw out a pie-in-the-sky number, $1 million. He explains why. The ransomware, WannaCry viruses that are going around, the institutions are so desperate to pay off those ransoms, they have to use Bitcoins to do it. That was his argument. The other argument comes from the venture capitalist who's opened up a university way out in Silicon Valley. Draper is calling for a much more, I think, conservative number of 100,000.
I think that you're absolutely right. It could be, you know, that these, that the value of a particular, of a Bitcoin or any crypto coin could end up being very, very high. But the worry here is that sort of the value here is in the eye of what people want to pay. It's not underlined by anything that's real. It's underlined by things that are in the ether, literally, etherware, whatever, Ethernet. And that might worry people. And that's why I think you need something that is real, that can be tied directly into the blockchain that defines these cryptocurrencies. And that will assure that you can't have somebody doing some sort of short raid or getting together and saying, let's sell this and get these things down very low. You won't, because they'll be able to fix the price of gold, which is out there and is something anchored in the ground and or above ground. Most of gold, a huge percentage of gold that exists on this planet has already been dug up. And if you could, you're going to have to anchor it to that to avoid, again, what could be, you know, a massive short raid on the world's reserve currencies. I mean, you know, that possibility might be reasonably remote. I don't know enough about everything that would go on there and what it would, you know, what it would take to do that. But you don't want that as a possibility on a worldwide reserve currency. And the way to avoid that is to make these different blockchains that are associated with the different cryptocurrencies backed by gold. Those blockchains, along with, again, I think several paper currencies, to me, I mean, I could be wrong on this, I'm guessing, but to me will be what defines the next reserve currency in the world. I mean, you'll probably have the SDR currencies. Renminbi will get a spectacularly high weighting. But gold and cryptocurrencies will be very, very much part of the mix. It only makes sense. You've got to have cryptocurrency. You can't send gold from shore to shore. You've got to have a way of keeping, you know, the identity of gold and how much, et cetera. And you know, cryptocurrencies are exactly what the Chinese are focusing on. And I think it's why they've spent so much time developing the kind of hardware they're going to need to create these cryptocurrencies and why they've stepped ahead of us.
The currency controls that are frightening the daylights out of institutions and Chinese citizens right now, and what a neat alternative. That seems to be a big driver here.
Yeah, I think it's a huge driver, and it could be, you know, I think people are sort of getting the sense that this world is, we're living through, Chris, in my opinion, a point of inflection. You know, as you said, the hardware, I mean, you're talking about quantum computers, they have certain limitations. I mean, you know, and I think that it will not be a very, it'll be a long time before you see a quantum computer being able to create a Bitcoin. Because, you know, it requires a lot of programming, a lot of calculations that are extremely, exceedingly complex, would be very, very hard to program in terms of quantum computation. But not true with, you know, what are today's supercomputers. And again, I come back to the fact that, you know, a decade ago, 15 years ago, I don't think China had any supercomputers. Now all of a sudden they have at least as many as the U.S., and they're on the verge of creating probably the first supercomputer, and that might be it. You might not be able to go any higher than that because these not because there's any physical limitations, but because these computers use so darn much energy that it's hard to get the energy. It's hard to situate them. And China, basically, again, I don't know whether this is because they thought so far ahead, but they have such a lead in hydroelectric power that they have probably 20 times as much hydroelectric power as the next largest country. That is so important because it's a free source of electricity. You don't need natural gas. You don't need oil. You don't need sun. You don't need wind. I mean, you don't have to count on, you know, sun shining, wind blowing, et cetera. You just count on water. And it's there. And it's cheap. It's not cheap. It's almost free. And that's where they've designed their, you know, major computing labs, right around these hydroelectric plants, which it's brilliant. I mean, you just have to salute them. I mean, you know, for how far advanced but how far in the future they have positioned themselves. And in terms of a world in which cryptocurrencies play a major role, it's astonishing, you know, how well prepared they are for this.
Nikola Tesla is just flipping around in his grave hearing you say this, because, as you know, he brought the whole concept of hydropower to Niagara Falls area. Yeah, lit up all of New York.
I mean, electric cars have been around forever. But, I mean, you know, again, I, you know, just sort of as a sidebar, when you look, you mentioned Tesla, and I look at Tesla with its valuation higher than that of GM, and I think some of that is merited. But Tesla will never be able to dominate the worldwide EV market because we don't have the resources here. I mean, literally, the hard resources. We don't have heavy rare earths, which is essential for creating the most efficient electric motor. Tesla's had to rely on a different type of motor. I believe it's called an induction motor. We don't have cobalt supplies, which are very important in creating the most efficient batteries. We don't have really graphite supplies, which are, you know, natural graphite. We have synthetic graphite, but you need oil, basically, to create synthetic graphite, and it turns out to be more expensive than the natural. China not only has these minerals that are needed for the battery and the engines of the most efficient electric cars, they also have a vertically integrated supply chain. They can take a heavy rare earth in the ground and turn it into a permanent magnet and insert it into the motor of an electric vehicle. We don't have access to any rare earths. So, you know, I think Musk, he probably is a total complete genius, but he's operating with one hand tied firmly behind his back, not of his own doing, but the doing of a government here that basically just was not foresightful. They were not thinking ahead. And you look at BYD, and I think I can't remember the initials, again, another acronym associated with the largest battery manufacturer in China. Basically, they dominate the rechargeable battery market, you know, because of their access to all these other minerals. You could multiply Tesla, you could multiply his IQ by 100. He can't create heavy rare earths. He just can't. We don't have it here. And we have fallen behind, and we just have to get on our horse. I'm not giving up on America. I love America. But, I mean, we just have to realize that we've got to be thinking far, far more ahead.
You've brought up so many great points here, and I'd just like to emphasize one thing about Nikola Tesla. That man created the entire electronics revolution, the electronic dynamo, which, as you know, runs those electric cars you're talking about, the wind power that we have, the fan in our windows, the fan in your computer and in your laptop, that he also created wireless technology that we're using in drones today. And his father would play a game with when he was very young, and the game was Read My Thoughts. And they would sit together and attempt to read each other's mind. And he claimed in some of his notes that that sparked much of his creativity. I just wanted to throw that out there.
It's absolutely true. And, you know, I think that there are factors beyond what you see on tests that really do define those people that are, you know, just extraordinary. And I think that, you know, again, I keep coming back to the Chinese, but I mean, their advantage over us is not that they're smarter in terms of IQ tests or any of these other tests, though they do exceptionally well, math and reading. It's because, you know, they have their nose to the grindstone. But there's also this kind of emotional intelligence and the fact that you're comfortable and yet you want to be creative. There's an urge to create. And I think that there's an urge to, you know, for the Chinese to think ahead. When the psychologists, you know, try and compare cultures, Asian or Eastern versus Western, and they show pictures, the Westerners tend to focus on the center of the picture, whereas the Easterners, the Asians, etc., they tend to focus on the entire picture. They want to get the entire panorama. And this is not something that, you know, is necessarily related to anything that we would say are numbers and symbols. It's just sort of an attitude. Again, sidebar. Right now I'm reading a series of three sci-fi books that were written and bestsellers in China. And they've come here. I mean, the first volume is called The Three-Body Problem. And it's
oh yeah, Henri Poincaré, one of my favorite mathematicians.
The birth of chaos. But, you know, this three-body problem is at the center of this book, which is interesting in itself, but that's not what really got to me. What got to me is that basically these books are dealing, I'm not giving away anything about them that you can't read on the covers of the books. These books are dealing with a problem, a major problem, I'll leave it at that, that is going to occur 450 years in the future. The Chinese are there preparing for it now. Extraordinary. I mean, Americans don't think like that. I mean, 450 years, if you told them that, you know, there's going to be something forward, if they told us, and me, I'm not being self-righteous about this. I'm at fault too. But if you told, I think almost, you know, that if you announced to the Americans that someone got on the phone, the president of the country got up there and tried to get people to work for a problem that was going to become real in 450 years, I think you'd just get a lot of blank stares. Yet, this trilogy of sci-fi stories is exactly about that. And it takes you through it. And it's, you know, it's fascinating. It really is. And it's wonderful reading for people that like sci-fi. I'm not a great sci-fi fan, but I find these books totally riveting on many, many different levels.
Well, you've piqued my interest. Can you toss us any hints on the title or the name or so we can look for them?
Sure. I mean, the title of the first book, in fact, I have, the title of the first book is The Three-Body Problem. Don't ask me to pronounce the name of the Chinese author. The title of the second one is The Dark Forest. You can get all these books on Amazon, and I'd rather mention them than my own book. And the title of the third one, I think, is something called After Death. Oh, Death's End. Death's End. That's the third one in the series. And I'd invest the time. If you find sci-fi interesting, you're going to find this stuff exceptionally interesting.
Oh, the third one really sounds exciting because I know where that's headed. And immortality, it has to be an uploading of consciousness.
No, you could be right. But these are books I think people should read to get an idea. You know, I've studied China very, very closely for a long period of time. I read and read and read. But I've probably learned more from reading their fiction than from their nonfiction. I mean, and one good takeaway here, and it's the Chinese are not looking for worldwide hegemony. They're looking for a better world for their people. I think they realize that that has to occur in the context of a better world for everybody.
I'm going to put links up on all of these. I've got it right here. The Dark Forest Remembrance of Earth's Past by Liu.
Death's End is now just in hard copy, as far as I can tell, but will come out in paperback very soon. The Three-Body Problem is the first. The Dark Forest is the second. Death's End is the third.
I've got them right here, Three-Body Problem, and it's just $8.96 on paperback. We're going to put all these links up.
Link them, and you know, hopefully the next time we talk, yeah, I can tell you the title of my new book, which will be on China and gold. I think we're going to call it Gold Alert, China Equal $10,000 Gold.
You know, he has another book. It's called The Wandering Earth.
You know, I'm just became aware of these because they were given to me as gifts, because people know I, you know, read a lot. And bear in mind, and one other thing I'll say, usually when you read these kinds of translations, especially going from Chinese to English, it can be, you know, terrible. This is a brilliant translation. These books are just something I look forward to. This is my treat.
Can't wait for the Three-Body Problem. I'm starting off there.
Like the next time, I hope to be able to give you the title for my own book. But right now, I think these three books are more important. If you Google me, if you just Google my name, you'll find a webpage you can go to. Next time, I'll have the information right in front of me.
Very excited. Dr. Lieb, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure as always.